Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Today is obviously 2022 midterm election day. So if you would like to watch our live coverage of Breaking Points, you should go check out the YouTube channel, Breaking Points. Obviously, it's going to be there around 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We're going to be doing results, analysis, all that great stuff. For today's episode, I wanted to do something completely unrelated to the direct political elections bit. So I'm speaking with Michael Gibson about his new book, Paper Belt on Fire, How Renegade Investors Sparked a Revolt Against the University. Michael led the Thiel Fellowship, which for those of you who don't know, was focused on offering promising young people $100,000 over 2 years to drop out of the university system and pursue big projects. We've done a lot of episodes this year on higher education, from the student loan debt issue to speaking to presidents of universities such as Johns Hopkins. So this is getting a completely different angle on that debate around the future of higher ed. This is definitely one I'd love to hear y'all's thoughts on. So definitely go to realignment.supercast.com. Check out the subscription, send us an email, all that great stuff. Hope you guys have a great day and enjoy the episode. And a huge thank you to Lincoln Network. Michael Gibson, welcome to The Realignment.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad to speak with you. I love metaphors to describe the current political, economic, cultural moments we're in. You've introduced a new one to me I'd never heard before. I think it's really interesting, the paper belt. What is the paper belt? And to play around with the title, is it that you think the paper belt is on fire right now, or you want to set it on
fire? So the origin of the term is goes back a few years. I'm friends with one of your previous guests, Balaji Srinivasan, and you know, back in I met him in 2012. We just got along and we'd go out and talk like drunken poets arguing, you know, over art in a cafe. And, you know, back in like 2013, 14, we started using this term, the paper belt, because there was the Rust Belt, which defined these industries in the Midwest that had been hollowed out by globalization or the inability to compete. And then, you know, the social carnage that had followed in its wake. And we started theorizing that maybe we're going to see a coming wave of innovation to attack a different region in the United States, which is what we decided to call the paper belt. So that refers to these paper-based industries and government bodies starting in Washington, D.C. Sometimes it's referred to like the Acela Corridor or I-95. In Washington, D.C., they print money on paper, laws, regulations, passports, visas. In Delaware, you incorporate on paper. In New York media, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Stock, Wall Street, all on paper. And then the last one would be maybe Boston, where Harvard and MIT are the pinnacle of the U.S. educational system and they're printing diplomas on paper. And our thought was that on the one hand, there are these forces that seem to be moving. And two of them, the first one would just be the institutions, the corporations and so on that make up that corridor are struggling in this world we're in. You know, Washington, D.C., from the Iraq War to the Federal Reserve, they've been struggling to perform their duties. Newspapers are falling apart. Their ad revenues are down and it's just become so polarized. So in its sense, it's like, yes, it seems to be burning. But Balaji and I, we took this more active position, like, and we should be trying to I don't want to give the impression like I'm some bomb throwing anarchist, but the idea would be like, can we replace? So in the sense of like Bitcoin was created to replace or at least shore up the failings of fiat central banking, maybe in a sense as well as like the medallions from taxi cabs, that's another paper-based system. And Uber and Lyft were in a sense a version of public transportation that you know did something different and better that people just saw right away. So yeah, there is it can be creative as well. I understand the title is provocative, but yeah, in a sense of like maybe the version one was like no one got to ride taxis, or maybe there were streetcars. Version two is that there are taxis and the supply of them is limited. And then version three is like something that comes next. But I think it is pretty clear that we're in a crisis right now where a lot of these institutions are failing or not performing as well as they should. And we need to find some way to either reform them, restore them, or replace them with something better. I wrote an essay in 2015. There was a, you know, the Washington consensus was this term among pundits that to describe the monetary and fiscal policy that they saw was best for the developing world. The Beijing consensus had emerged out of China as an authoritarian government powered by capitalism, but duly restrained. And then, you know, reading through Satoshi Nakamoto's papers and so on, he called this mechanism that provides verification in the blockchain, the Nakamoto consensus. And so I thought, yes, this Nakamoto consensus was going to rival in its decentralized way the institutions of these two other systems. I wrote this essay. It was published in an academic book. And the only paragraph that people remember is the one about the paper belt. And so I put that on my LinkedIn. And then the publisher Encounter, when we were thinking up a title, the editors were like, wow, that is provocative. Let's go with that. So yeah, long story there, but covers a lot of the ground in the theme, I guess.
No, for sure. And I hope you and listeners will forgive me. We're going to kind of jump around a bit because what I like about the book is you're writing the tale of the Thiel Fellowship, which I'll let you explain in a second.
Yep.
But you're also writing about big science educational problems that our society still needs to confront. So it's hard to outline this show in a perfect,
Time.
So we're gonna jump around a bit. Here's a question that I'm particularly interested in hearing from you.
Yep.
You write in the book about how our K-12 educational system is broken, and in many ways, like you're trying to stand up challengers to that system. But we just went through the past year where there's this whole discourse, I've done a couple episodes of this, where there was hardcore COVID learning loss.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, that doesn't necessarily, so the idea that like not having kids in school, mm-hmm. so what happens, you know, kids don't go to school and you just see like generationally defining losses of knowledge. This doesn't repudiate your broader critique of the K-12 educational system, but I want you to kind of like reckon with that notion.
Sure.
It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, we have seen a lot of learning loss, as you know, described by performance on tests of certain kinds, and I think that is it appears to be this tragedy of COVID that maybe, and especially because children weren't affected as badly, and maybe they should have been in school. I think that's important. But one of the weird things about education, I find, is that you know it's hard to measure exactly what people are learning. And then what's more is we do nothing to verify that they retain that learning over time. In fact, what we see is that people tend to forget a lot of what they, I mean, anecdotally, I don't remember. I studied French for years in high school and college, and I feel like I can barely speak a sentence anymore when I go there. So learning loss is quite a big deal. And so what I might argue in this instance is, yes, there does appear to be learning loss compared to the previous year. But I wonder, is this like what people might fall back to anyway when they leave school altogether? Is that maybe you test them while they're in school and it looks like they have certain skills, but then over time they forget them, they rust, and so on. And the reason I say that is it is appalling just the state of our education in this country. I mean, take something like literacy. Somewhere on the order of like 23-24% of adult Californians are functionally illiterate. I think that is strong. I doubt they were, you know, maybe they could have scored better on those tests when they were in K-12. Maybe they drop out, but it's certainly worse now. So this is maybe a longer way of saying maybe that learning loss was going to happen anyway after people left school. So that's what I would argue against that. It's like it seems to be bad, but maybe when they left school in 5 years or 10 years, they were going to forget a lot of what they learned anyhow. So that's like a broader challenge to the educational system that I think a lot of people don't take into consideration, is just how much people forget of what they learned.
Yeah, I'd like to then root you then specifically with the Thiel Fellowship and your very, I'd say, direct challenge at a conceptual level to credentialing, higher education status quo. It's not quite as related to K through 12. There are like philosophical implications of it, but just introduce the Thiel, like take us back to like 2010, the Thiel Fellowship, what you were seeing about the world that you saw this as a corrective towards, and then we'll get a little deeper on it.
Yeah, sure. So the consensus story about college and then even education earlier is that people are learning skills, and these skills are valuable in all sorts of ways. So, you know, some people point to that a well-functioning democracy requires an educated citizenry, all the way to you see the wage premiums that college grads have over, you know, people who just have a high school degree and so on. And the standard explanation is always, well, that difference is driven by the knowledge that people acquire and skills while they're in school. But, you know, something I just pointed to before is something that stands out, like on an anecdotal level, is like, why is it that it's okay to forget things, but not, but if you fail them, it's way worse. So it's like, if I have a wage premium because I went to college, it should be because I learned something in college, but I just told you I forgot a ton of things. So why should I be paid for that? So that's a little bit of a puzzle. And then there's a whole research literature on some other things that stand out. The number one thing might be something called the sheepskin effect, which is, the last year that people, the senior year in college, and for people who finish that last year, is worth more in wages than the previous 3 years combined.
And so that's someone like drops out right after junior year.
That's what you're kind of referring to. Skills all the way through, and they, you know, do 3 out of 4 years. Or you could like make up the most fanciful thought experiment. Imagine someone who, like, on the way to the final exam for their last class senior year, gets hurt in an accident. They go to the hospital. The professor's really mean and is like, oh, you're not going to be able to make up the exam. That person theoretically has like 99.9% of all the skills, according to that theory. And so, you know, we should expect them to make as much in the labor market. But that's not true. So, yeah, it's like if without completing college, the wage differential is quite strong. So that points to something like, wow, what is it about completing college that signals something to the labor market independently of the skills that are acquired during that time? And the number one theory is this idea that, you know, the degree is more about signaling something, that it's, you're signaling some attributes about your character that, you know, the university lets you do in a way that, you know, just taking a test or whatever will not let you. So sure, there's intelligence involved, but there are also other things like, are you willing to follow through a four-year project and complete it? Are you willing to be obedient and compliant across 4 years and take orders and get them done? So that's a whole theory on higher education. All that was kind of in the air in 2010. And Peter Thiel, my old boss, he's had his own disagreements with college over the years, going back 35 years now, back to when he was on Stanford's campus. A lot of that was the culture war stuff. And by 2008, 2009, he thought he could start a rival university. So he was thinking of some of these cultural issues that, you know, and things were even less polarized then than they are now. But he thought, maybe much in the way the University of Austin is trying now, can you set up a new university that isn't susceptible to some of these political ideas? And at the time, his research, he just came to a dead end. He couldn't, you know, prestige is really important if you're after credentials. Trying to like bootstrap that is really hard. It's very expensive. You need to be accredited, which requires getting approval from all these insiders. So he just concluded that that was impossible. And then, you know, Peter hired me for one thing. And then I showed up to work the first day, and I can tell you the day because it was my first day at work. It was September 27th, 2010. And I guess the night before, he had come up with this idea to start a grant program that would take that signaling story about education seriously, which is that, you know, maybe if you already have the ability to, you know, that you're already intelligent, you're already a critical thinker, and maybe you want to start something on your own or get started outside of universities, maybe this grant could be a way for you to get started. And the reason you could is because you don't have to signal anything to the labor market. And so, yeah, I showed up to work and then someone comes to my desk and they're like, okay, we got to go to Peter's house. TechCrunch Disrupt is today. It's this big conference. And we got to announce this anti-Rhodes scholarship. That was the first name for this because I guess they had a Peter had his thoughts about the Rhodes scholars. There's some line like they all have a great future in their past, which is pretty harsh. But yeah, so we get in the car and then on the fly, we're like, OK, what do we call this thing? How many years? And then Peter's interviewed on stage at TechCrunch and he's talking about this in the present tense, like it already exists. He's like, oh, we're taking applications. And so, yeah, we started this Thiel Fellowship program that was $100,000 for 2 years. There were two noteworthy conditions on the grant. Number one, you had to be 19 and under when you applied. And then you had to not be enrolled in school during the 2 years. And so when we announced that day, you know, suddenly the press went crazy. You know, Peter Thiel's telling people to drop out and stuff. And we weren't telling everyone to drop out, but we just thought, could it be interesting as a wedge to create a alternative path to a fulfilling and rewarding career? And but like, yeah, the exaggeration was to say, okay, we're telling everyone to drop out, don't go to school, whatever. But no, we were trying to say, hey, let's try this niche first and see where it goes. And yeah, so I helped get that started and co-ran that program for 5 years.
A million different questions here. I think this is important to set up because a lot of listeners don't work in tech, but you know, I work in tech, you're a venture capitalist. There's a joke on Twitter that's going around that I think kind of signifies that to a certain degree, your thesis was correct and you've kind of won. People have said, okay, now there's too much dropping out. Dropping out is too much of a signal. I know a bunch of these people got into Harvard, got into Stanford, drop out after that first year. Yeah. And that is prestigious in of itself. So it's kind of a confounding variable when it comes to dropping out, and it's not widely accepted. I mean, obviously I'm not going to say that everyone has a fine enough example of it, but what I will just say, at least on, you know, Twitter and some of the circles we run into, if you're the type of person who could now get a Thiel Fellowship and you were leave Harvard, Stanford, MIT, you are likely going to do fine. The world looks different than it does in 2010.
I think that's right.
Why is what I just articulated, why was that so controversial back in 2010? This just seems like, I mean, not that, because once again, you put yourself on a limb here. This isn't easy. But it seems like this was obvious. Like, why did this provoke such a risk? You were claiming we're going to fund a million people. We're going to go into the depths of a third tier state university and say, hey, leave for you know, the next 3 years. Like, why was this controversial?
I think the number one thing might just be like this contagion effect that people were worried about for some reason. So you had like Jacob Weisberg, a columnist at Newsweek. He thought that by encouraging, maybe these like intellectual elites to pursue this path, that somehow that would trickle down and like people who are on the margin who might benefit through more education, like that they're going to be discouraged. I think that was like Lawrence Summers, former president of Harvard, Treasury Secretary. He like said something, his quote is something like, the Thiel Fellowship is the most misdirected philanthropy of the decade. And I think and then he says something like, and it'd be a shame if someone went to Harvard and left. And so I think there was this fear of contagion that somehow through role models, these successful people, that somehow it would send the wrong message down the chain, I suppose. But, you know, maybe that's not a bad thing. It's like the college has it like college. The wage premium is real, but it's just not for the reason that people think. And so it can be very valuable for you know, individuals to go to college in order to distinguish themselves in that way. But there are all sorts of people where, you know, maybe too many people are getting pushed down this path. And it's not just the tech bro. It's also, you know, the person who works, who maybe has an inclination for a trade, but because there's this monopath to success now in the US that's defined by the college degree, you know, they're the people who are not finishing, you know, something that I can't remember the number, but it could be like 50% of people don't graduate in 4 years or over 6 years. So a lot of people don't finish. They accumulate that. We can all agree that the college debt problem is real, $1.7 trillion. It costs too much, and maybe people aren't learning the skills. So like, you know, maybe it is a good message to the person who wants to become a contractor or an electrician, that, you know, maybe that path is worthy and shouldn't be denigrated. So yeah, I don't know, you know, it touched a nerve, and I think it was because that, I think, and then maybe behind that is this idea that education is the solution, is the way to keep the American dream alive, that somehow for individuals, the only way they could possibly rise from, you know, the lower class to the middle class and on up is through education. And there are, you can point to stories where that may be true, but like even that, you know, over time, it's like the economists studying that stuff now, it's like college hasn't been the engine of social mobility that that myth seems to portray. So yeah, I don't know. It must've touched that some kind of, cause the reaction was more like, not you're wrong. It's more like you violated a taboo and this was sacred.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you have other thoughts, but that's sort of my thinking on that.
Well, it's interesting because, and this is why I'm glad you started the episode off the way you did by focusing on that sheepskin problem mm-hmm. with that last year of college. To borrow a phrase from like the, you know, from the academic left, like social construction.
Yeah.
So many defenses of the higher education status quo seem to me to come down to college is this social construction. We can't quite articulate what pure literal like worth emerging from this, but people kind of have to do it. And I'd say the other thing too is always, I think this is what provokes a bit of the controversy, which is that there's obviously like the liberal arts argument of, well, Michael, you're suggesting that people just leave. And if, you know, right. Zuckerberg had it, and this is just like tech press, like conventional wisdom at this point, but if Zuckerberg had, you know, stayed at Harvard and taken Gov 220, he somehow would have come to different conclusions about, you know, social media regulation, which like left, right, or center, regardless of your opinions on Mark Zuckerberg, I just refuse to believe that the difference in his management of Facebook or Meta would have come down to like a 200 to 300 to 400 level like government class. Like I've met plenty of Harvard grads.
It's so funny.
I refuse to believe that.
I mean, there's a long list of evil people who have graduated with liberal arts degrees from around the world, but also Harvard.
Yeah.
You know, one of the most famous ones I recently discovered was apparently the guy who invented the Zeke Hale in Germany was an early college Harvard grad. He invented it during, he was a cheerleader for the football team. He became friends with Hitler. So I'm just like, how could, you know, if that's, it's like we're talking counterexamples. Another, like people talk about Elizabeth Holmes the same way that maybe she wouldn't have committed fraud like she did if she had finished Stanford. And I'm just like, okay, there are just too many people, wrongdoers, criminals, and so on, who have had this education. Even Eichmann tried to defend himself by appealing to Kant's philosophy. So the idea, it's like, I am a believer in that, you know, poetry and philosophy and literature are a means of soul craft. I just think we haven't figured out yet how it works. You know, colleges, like you said, they tout all these benefits. And this is the pushback against the, you know, you forgot your education argument. So it's like, yeah, you forgot French, Mike, but you know what? You learned how to think. You learned how to look things up and analyze them and synthesize them. But, you know, in some of the research I dug into, that's not true either. So it's like there's a field that studies this. It's the psychology of education. The term they use is transfer of learning. In 90 years of research, and these are people who are highly motivated, who want to believe that what you learn in one domain can be applied in another, they have found like no results. And they say, like, you know, in fact, the schools are failing in this dimension. So, you know, my big analogy joke now is like if universities were a drug, the FDA would ban it, because they, if you go to any of their mission statements, they say they have this purpose to educate people for citizenry, to teach them not what to think, but how to think, to enrich their lives, to create almost an intellectual aristocracy. And yet they show no evidence that they do this. It's like they're these things would be hard to measure because the most important intangible things can be. But the fact that they haven't even tried speaks to the point that, you know, no one really cares about this. Truly.
And this is the hard part. There's so many confounding variables to that description of the intellectual elite thing. So like if you're talking about Harvard could obviously claim justifiably that much of this country's intellectual elite has passed through Cambridge. But right. to your point, okay, is that as simple as, does anyone actually know what happened at campus during those 4 years? Or no. am I, as a podcast booker, just say, oh, hey, like this person went to Harvard. I'm going to assume that their PhD is kind of worth something. So it's just, yeah. it's this weird mix.
Yeah, there's the ability yeah. bias. So it's like at 18, you already are, you know, smart and capable of ripping apart arguments and doing all this stuff. Colleges, you know, they don't really measure that. And I mean, there's SATs and GPAs, so maybe like indirectly. So you step on campus, but then when you leave, they don't like measure the difference. Like, oh, look, you improved on these dimensions. You know, learning to me is just broadly defined as improvement along some dimension. It's like if you play sports, you know, you're getting better at golf. There should be some way to tell that you got better at that. And I think the same thing is true of, you know, analyzing poetry or, you know, reaching for profound insights and philosophy and so on. And like, I don't think pointing to the grades you got is enough because, yeah, there's it, like you stepped on foot on campus and then you left. What was the difference? All right, this is the drug trial thing. They should be saying, OK, here was the treatment. Here's the change. You know, we saw this amount of effectiveness and the side effects weren't so bad.
So here's where I'd like to ask you 2-part questions. So part one would be, could you talk about some of the Thiel Fellowship success stories? And sure. then I would like to hear what those success stories have to do with the rest of us. In the sense that yeah. I met Laura Deming, Longevity right. Fund.
Yep.
Okay. You give her a bunch of money. Not that that's, you know, as simple as this is, but you give her a bunch of money. Most people, if you meet Laura, you're not going to be shocked that she yeah. was successful. What does that have to do with a bright, smart, moderately ambitious guy, let's say in like Portland or Texas, where I'm from?
Right.
What does that have to do with the rest of us if you're critiquing this broader system?
That's the hardest question I get, I think. Yeah, when I was like out public trying to get the book published, you know, the first pushback was, yeah, what is this? What good is this for the ordinary American? And so, yeah, to speak to some of the, like the successes to show like how far of an outlier they are. In 2013, I met Vitalik Buterin. He was a skinny Russian guy.
He still is a skinny Russian guy.
Yes, yeah. right. Dresses, you know, funny and like vaporwave tees and stuff. And he was, yeah, pitching us some ideas about how the blockchain underlying Bitcoin could be repurposed towards these other ends. And, you know, I blew my mind away. You know, I looking back on it and doing the research for the book, it turned out like he had written the Ethereum white paper 5 days before we had lunch with him. So it was pretty fresh in his mind. We awarded him a Thiel Fellowship, helped him launch Ethereum in the summer in 2014. And now, yeah, everyone knows what Ethereum is. And it is, you know, could possibly provide the infrastructure for, you know, the next wave of the internet. That's just billions and billions of dollars worth of value. And Vitalik is an incredible person. I saw him chatting in Chinese on his phone and I asked him, when did you learn Chinese? And he's like, oh, I just taught myself in the last year because I have to communicate with Ethereum developers in China. And so that speaks to, he does have an extraordinary mind and discipline to learn things that probably is on the order of like, you know, maybe to, for the athletics analogy, maybe it's like an Olympian compared to like a weekend warrior. Another person is Dylan Field. He's the founder of Figma, co-founder of Figma. That's famous recently because it was just Figma was acquired by Adobe for $20 billion. Figma is one of the top design tools that, you know, engineers use nowadays. It's just everywhere. And we helped Dylan launch that in 2012. So those are some of the successes. Yeah, that's a great question. I think it comes back to, you know, the role model thing where I don't think, yeah, not everyone is going to start a company without a college degree. And the company thing is good because, as I said, you don't have to convince a boss to hire you to start a company. You are your own boss. But my hope is that what we're starting to see is like for the things that you can directly measure, like in the coding, you know, I'm not telling everyone to become a coder, but there is this thing where either you have the ability to build or you don't. And so what we've seen is that a number of people have been hired to get jobs at Google, Amazon, Facebook, and they don't have degrees just because they can now point to their GitHub repository that's been validated by their peers and colleagues, and then that's their resume and they get hired. So what I think has to happen is that we have to see more of this where, you know, the Thiel Fellowship, in a sense, authenticated people with money. It presented a reference. It helped them establish their reputation. I think the inspiration is that we have to trust people more and help them establish their reputation somehow in a way that they can start their career without necessarily going into debt through college. So that would be the path forward for me. I don't know if it's an inspiration or just a pragmatic thing, but if we can set up like a network of professionals, you know, how do we get, you know, for someone who wants to become the VP of Walmart or something else that's not like exciting or but nevertheless is a solid career, I think that is the replacement pathway. Is like, in the way that the Thiel Fellowship did help establish someone's reputation, can you build them enough credibility over some period of time that the next person's willing to hire them or vouch for them and so on? So it's a hard question. And I think there's a long way to go on that idea I just mentioned. But I do think we do need to keep pushing, because I think we're way too complacent in the current system where people just have to go to college and get the degree and go in the debt or whatever.
Yeah. And just thinking out loud here, I think my answer to the tough question is I'm kind of reframing my head, the Thiel Fellowship, not as an assault on the American higher education system, because A, you're not creating enough Thiel Fellows to actually do that.
Yeah.
And B, some people, you know, like do Thiel Fellowship and then they end up going to college anyways.
Yeah. For me, they go back, right.
At its best, it's a attack on empty and arbitrary credentialism.
Right.
I mean, it's an attack on just the idea that just because someone goes to college, just because someone goes to Harvard, that being the inherent like goal of this process. Because too often, and this isn't just even a Harvard problem. I think if we're looking at why are people dissatisfied with their college degrees across the board? Why are folks having trouble translating their actual wage premium into an ability to pay off debt? It's because too often it's just an empty thing, to your point about like learning loss and retention there. So at its best, I think I would hope someone in higher education, I had the president of Johns Hopkins on, I would hope that he would read a book like this in a perfect world and say, okay, obviously I'm not going to burn down the higher ed system, but the number one task I have in front of me is this cannot just be a socially constructed credential that is ultimately inarticulatable. Because I would be honest if I talked to a lot of folks who go to school, top tier state school, community college or otherwise, unless they're in STEM, they might have the hardest time articulating what they actually specifically got beyond the social fun parts, right? Which are awesome. Yeah. And that's actually college's strongest, right? Actual like value add there. How do you think about this dynamic?
That's good. I think sometimes I characterize college by its main architectural features, and everything we've talked about today is the main feature you see on just about 95% of every campus, which is the clock tower. It's like you have to be on campus. Everything is timed, your exams, the number of credits you take and so on. And that's sort of what I'm attacking here, is like how valuable is the clock tower. But the other buildings, I don't know what will replace them. One of them would be the like we've mentioned, the student life. I mean, that could be like the fraternity, the sorority, the social club. The other one would be, quite frankly, the stadium. It's like people love this affiliation they get from the schools they're a part of. It's like this tribal loyalty that they were to. Like I've seen 45-year-old men painting their faces and going to bars to support these student athletes, quote, you know, student athletes. That level of commitment and loyalty, I think, speaks to something deeper than just like taking classes somewhere. And you know, people retain that through their lives. And then the other part that's tied to this is the admissions office. So the admissions office is really what also part of this, where it's like, okay, they're selecting people. It's very exclusive. They could open enrollment, but they don't. That forms the dating pool that now people are, you know, finding their spouses through the admissions office, in a sense. Their friends. So attacking that clock tower about like the skills, how do you measure them? Okay, that's one problem. But these other things, I think, are sources of meaning in people's life. And I don't know what necessarily replaces them. You know, part of that is also the it's like, maybe this is like more primordial, is like, you see this in mammals in general, where, you know, at some point in the life of the children, they have to embark out away from their parents and their family. And then in our lives, there are these, you know, going back thousands of years, these rites of passages like the bar mitzvah. Okay, now you're an adult. For some reason, I think college has tapped into this in a primordial way, where that is the time in your life when you go off and find yourself. And so I think culturally too, that plays a part. Like, how do you replace that? Because, you know, are people just going to stay home? And like, you know, my mom, when she talks to me about this stuff, she grew up in Bisbee, Arizona, a copper mining town. And she went to Arizona State University in Phoenix. And she was like, that was my cultural ticket out. I would have been in this small town, mining town. And maybe, yeah, the education didn't serve me, but I went to Phoenix and it just opened me up to the wider world and gave me a sense of the possibilities. So I think those are all problems that are, it's like, okay, how can we, it's unbundling in a way, is a business way to say it, but how do you address these things that people do find valuable in college? I don't quite know if the Thiel Fellowship helped, because they were a group, helped them identify them. So, you know, they had their peers that they could be a part of. But if you're just an individual, I mean, maybe you can say like, oh, you're going to Hollywood to become an actor or whatever. People get that, but it's totally unintelligible right now if you just tell them, hey, you know, I'm going to start a business. Or what? It just seems like you're giving up on life. It's denigrated in a sense. And culturally, I don't like that. I think I've wandered far from your original question.
No, it's the discourse, so it's good.
Yeah. I think there still are these unresolved issues. And so if I did talk to the Johns Hopkins, you know, president, I think I would have to acknowledge that stuff. And maybe Johns Hopkins still serves that for people. I don't know, maybe like some people, maybe we could push for regulations to suggest like, and I'm not a regulation person, but it would be great if, you know, maybe student loans were tied to future employment. And in a sense, then the college would have a greater incentive to try to give people the school or the skills they need. Maybe it's like you try to find a way to eliminate that signaling mechanism and make it more about the skills acquired. I'm not quite sure what the policy lever is to do that, but I think those would all be good moves.
See, it's funny. I'm not really a libertarian, but it's when we start talking about those regulations that my most libertarian instinct comes out, because like, let's talk it out, right? Because if you start forcing schools to focus on outcome, like very explicitly, okay, that operationally creates a world where the only kids who get to study poli-sci and like, you know, jerk around for 4 years are upper middle class kids like myself. And you then have everyone else going to the STEM mine. So it seems to me, and this is why I think your efforts are important, the more effective model for solving this long-term isn't going to be some bureaucrat at the Department of Higher Education, at the Department of Education in DC saying, we want to produce 50 poli-sci grads to 117.3 engineering grads. I think the better system is to actually have open and honest conversations with alternatives. That's kind of because I just genuinely don't want a world where only where the fun parts of college are just something that gets to go to kids who could afford to pay out of pocket.
Yeah.
Because that's what I see inevitably happening with that regulation.
Right. And so like, the more like radical take I would have is that we should just stop funding college. This is like, we should, if it is creating these negative externalities where, you know, the social waste created by people trying to compete along credentialing lines rather than skills, then the answer, the libertarian answer is, well, we should stop, you know, funding it through taxpayer dollars and then just see if it passes the market test. And then if it is something where it's like, you know, these people, only the wealthier people get to enjoy their 4 years, well, then you tax it and discourage it. It's like,
escalating levels. you just talked yourself into like this libertarian hellhole of being the person who's forced to end up turning into a technocrat that way. Yeah. Here's another question. I'm actually super curious what you think about this. So we've talked about the Thiel Fellowship, but obviously 1517 fund, like you're investing in dropouts. And I'd love to hear from a news you can use perspective. Mm-hmm. Shout out to University of Oregon. I'm wearing my Bowerman sweatshirt. I did not get literally anything academically from the poli sci department. Nothing at all. Like, not great. Right. Didn't get good grades. Didn't retain anything. Okay. But like, what I have managed to do though is I now podcast. Like, I did an interview for Cambridge Professor an hour or two before yours. That is how I have been able to use Zoom and the internet to learn. Yeah. And like, obviously, I got funded to start the podcast, and everyone could do that. But like, when you're just looking at this idea of people are either like not wanting to go to college or they're wasting 4 years like I did from a pure learning perspective, how do you help dropouts? Not like at a personal advice level, but how should a dropout or someone who's looking to learn, how should they think of their future?
I think there's a great school that provides the skills needed to survive in the workplace and thrive. And that place is the workplace. It's like, I think now that's why I use that term, establish your reputation or get established somehow, is there. You have to find that first incremental step, whether it's like working for free. I mean, talk about like a gift that college students get is the ability to take these internships that pay nothing. In some ways, the minimum wage law is good. We could argue about that. But one part where it's really bad is that it does prevent people from just taking jobs to learn, is like to get those first few weeks or months in where you can learn the skills of the job and get started. My advice to people is always to try to find other people in that industry you want to work in, talk to them, you got to get the information about what it takes to get hired. And maybe that is just like scanning through the job boards and seeing what the role requires and then building out a map. Okay, how do I prove that I have these skills? But it really, I find the personal level goes way further because it shows you have the drive and the commitment. So if you're going out of your way and you meet someone and you're telling them how excited you are to work for them and learn from them, I think you can get further without a degree or any kind of credential than most people think. You're going to have to put in the time. You know, any real job requires mastery of some fundamentals before you move on to harder, more complex things. I think, we talked about the trades a little bit, and they have this model of apprenticeship to journeyman to mastery. I think that applies to everything. Even the highest, most theoretical sciences rely on tacit knowledge acquired from people who are previous masters and so on. And I think we would do well to speak more broadly about that as a society, because I think the trades and then even working as a marketer or some of these softer skills could be learned the same way. And so, I would encourage people to do that. We do our best, and make investments in companies. Our companies are all hiring. It's like, we can't find people to work for these companies enough. You know, it's like, they just need so many roles filled. And so what we're trying to do is, maybe we're not investing in dropouts. We're also trying to get them hired in these companies and help them out there. But I wish, more broadly as a society that, we did things to help people get started more directly. Like, okay, what is the concrete step you take in order to learn how to become this type of person?
I think the next and biggest last question here, once again, my pitch for the book is that you're not just talking about Teal Fellowship, victory lap stories. Like, you have like a broader critique of the status quo. There's a great Bill Gates anecdote that I'll let book readers get into at the start there. But you're making a broad critique of our inability as a society to advance and progress in areas of science and technology. So you've got this cool coda at the end where you're kind of talking about different problems, different challenges. Can you just do like a closing segment of this episode? Just like, what are problems, categories that you, like, as both a like former academic, but also as an investor, like, what should listeners, younger ones, folks in high school, like, what should they be focusing on from an energy perspective?
Right. So the book is like two books in one, at least. One of them is this adventure story about I have no business being in VC. Dropped out of being an academic. My co-founder is Danielle Strackman, former school principal, charter school founder. It's like, most VCs aren't like that. Here's our adventure story, working with Teal Fellows. But then, you know, what that story made me realize was it ties into this idea that this idea of the great stagnation, that, maybe the rate of progress isn't what you know, Silicon Valley and its press releases want us to believe. Especially, okay, we can grant that computers and communications technologies have advanced fast from 1970 now. But if you go sector by sector in these other parts of the economy and try to measure how much progress we've made in the last 40 years, it's not quite clear that we've made a whole lot. You know, one of them could be, I mean, we touched on education. It's like we're spending more money to educate people about the same, maybe a little better, maybe a little worse. But no one argues, you know, if we're paying 4x in real terms more than we used to, no one says education's four times better than it used to be. But we could go to energy creation. We don't have to get in the debates about global warming and leaving, you know, fossil fuels aside. I think gas is great, but I think we do in the long run have to develop these other technologies. And there are these unsolved problems that are just waiting there to be solved. So if you think about fusion energy, for, you know, 50, 60 years now, we've known how to ignite a star on Earth. That is, you know, profound to me in ways that I can't explain, that, like, you know, for billions of years, as far as we know, stars are only created one way in this universe. And some people figured out, okay, we could spark the same reaction on Earth. But, you know, you create this hot plasma, it's tough to control, it requires energy to contain. No one has been able to solve these problems. So yeah, what I realized is, like, as I went through sector by sector, and this is really challenging because we live in a specialized world, is trying to figure out what are the unsolved problems in each of these fields, where if we made major advances, if you decided to work on this problem and you solved it, you'd win a Nobel Prize. What would that look like? And so I went through fusion, nuclear and energy, wind and solar, geothermal. And then you could look at, let's say, water in the American West, where I live. It's very dry, and we see fires with greater frequency and intensity. And so this idea, how do we create more fresh water? It's like, I thought if education, you know, as it's done now, it's almost scaffolded. In physics, you've got to learn Newton before you study Einstein. And then before you study quantum mechanics, you got to master these things. And so by the time it's only by the time you're 30 or so that you get started on your career. I thought, what if we flipped that upside down and we told 15-year-olds and 16-year-olds, as they walk into the building of the physics department, or 18-year-olds on campus, there was a top 10 list of all the problems that hadn't been solved. The greatest minds, the professors you're working with, have not solved these problems. So how great are they? Well, no, they're not. We got to solve. We got to keep working on these. And so that was my agenda there. I thought it would show how little advance we've made. And then I hoped it would inspire someone to say, oh my God, wow, there's so much that we don't actually know. We don't know why people are gaining weight over the last 40 years. It seems to be sugar, but that's a complicated story because sugar consumption is down over the last 10, 15 years. And yet people seem to, diabetes is still increasing. We still have not cured cancer after, you know, 50 years or four, since Nixon declared war on cancer. So, you know, yeah, I thought it would be fun to end the book with a more inspirational note that, you know, no matter who you are, where you come from, if you solve any of these problems, you will go down in history. And there are a lot of them out there. That to me was like, I didn't want to end on saying, okay, we started this program, we're doing this thing with the 1517 fund. I really wanted to challenge society, because I think it's a book about creativity. I think part of the stagnation is that, and whether it's the universities or, you know, the broader world, is I think we don't understand creativity at all. We don't know how to, you know, promote it in individuals. We don't, it's like, these flourish, and this includes the arts as well. It's like there are these movements. It seems to be that the Renaissance wasn't an era, it was a place, you know, that people who knew each other working, and those types of things grow and then fade and fall out. And then cities have this. So in my time in Silicon Valley, I saw San Francisco go from, you know, when I arrived in 2010, it was the Athens of the modern world. Everyone dreamed of a new technological renaissance. And when I left in 2020, it was a dystopian nightmare. So I saw the ecosystem destroyed. And then as a whole, America, yeah, it seems to be that we've lost our mojo. And, you know, from the Civil War to maybe the moon landing, we were the most technologically, scientifically creative civilization. But since then, I think we've lost our step. So I I want to inspire people. I don't have all the answers about how to promote creativity, but I thought it would be interesting to use my story and the people I've worked with to really try to illuminate that area that is still remains a mystery. Is like, why are some nations more creative than others? Why is the same nation more creative at one time than it is at a previous time? These are questions I think economists and historians haven't adequately answered. And so I thought, to the extent that I could address that stuff in the book, the better. And ending on this note, like, okay, how do we get it back? Well, there's just this list of things. If we knock these down, we're not going to tell people the meaning of life, that maybe the liberal arts have that still, how to love, how to live. But you know what? As the current situation with Ukraine and Russia has shown, energy security and creation is a real issue. And if we solve that, my God, we'll be in a good place.
That's a great place to end it, because it kind of dovetails with thought that I've picked up just from interacting with folks in the tech industry, the venture capital industry. I had Catherine Boyle from A16Z on, and talking about how founders are going to be well suited to the emerging political moment, in the sense that if you're a founder of a company and all trying to just do tech pointless optimism, but you're kind of focused on, here's this problem, and my job as a founder, as a CEO, early stage employee, PM, is to solve this problem. And when you're talking about how there are just like these 10 things that we could solve, I think a hopeful vision for American politics would be, okay, we're not going to get Americans to perfectly agree with, let's say, exactly what should be taught in elementary to high schools right. when it comes to race. That's going to be different in Texas. It's going to be different in Oregon. It's going to be different in New York. What we can do and come together as a society around our, we should have energy security. And I think if we could have a political class that is oriented around that, you could focus attention there instead of just on emergent and just consistently pendulum swinging battles. You just go that direction. So I just think anyone, even if you're not going into college right now, kind of trying to think around like, what are those 10 issues? And if you focus there, I think you could be kind of optimistic, because there's a reason why, semiconductor microchip policy has been one of the few areas of bipartisan agreement the past 2 years. And that's been because the literal articulation is, holy crap, we don't want to not have literal tech if there's a conflict with China. And that's actually been an organizing principle. It's helped people work together on things.
Yeah, one of the things I uncovered was there's a book called The Politics of Innovation. I think the author, I can't remember his name right now, but the main thesis of his book is that one of the driving forces of innovation is this insecurity. So it's like cross-country comparisons. I mean, Israel is a great example where, maybe the threat of everyone around them has generated a lot of incentives for them to innovate. And I think to some degree that's true in these topics, energy, semiconductors, and so on. I think it is clear that we don't have a choice. Maybe it's like, there are some people who I think tech can be scary and dangerous. The thought of Skynet or Big Brother is certainly frightening. But the situation we're in is I think much like a free solo climber, where we could, to go down is going to be even more dangerous. And that would be to, restore ourselves to some, 1500 agrarian ideal. There are 7 billion mouths to feed. This isn't going to happen. And also, if we stay where we are, we're also toast. We can't just say, okay, we've advanced enough. We have to stay, it's like all these other forces out of our control, the threat from China, asteroids, whatever. We can't stay where we are. So I think, with speed and virtue, we have to continue climbing the best we can, making good decisions.
That's a great place to leave it. Michael, thank you so much for joining me on the show. Everyone, Peterborough on Fire is coming out later this month, so be sure to check out our bookshop or Amazon review, purchase your books, and pre-order that out later this month. Thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Thanks, Marshall. It was great.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.